funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What accounts for the enduring alliance between the United States and Australia? And is there a particular affinity between the land down under and the vast expanses and fiercely independent culture of Texas? Direct flights from DFW Airport to Brisbane with continuing service to Sydney begin today on Qantas Airways, which should make travel more convenient for the nearly 500,000 Americans who visit Australia and the 50,000 Australians who visit Dallas alone each year. His Excellency Kim Beazley is Australia's ambassador to the United States. He came to town to speak this morning to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth, and we are delighted he could make time to be with us this afternoon. Ambassador Beazley, welcome to Think.
Well, it's a real pleasure to be here, Chris. It's, for me, it's just like old times. I used to be in politics, and of course you did radio interviews all the time, but I got out of practice over the course of the last few years, I'm afraid to say. So it's lovely to be back here, well, here for the first time, but back in the business again.
Now, officially, you retired, what, in 2006?
2007, I retired from Parliament, mm-hmm. Yeah, and then went back to academic life. Mm-hmm. And was offered a couple of years ago, was offered the ambassadorship here, so I took it like a shot.
And that's about a 23-hour-a-day job, isn't it?
Yeah, it because of the time zone changes.
Yeah. So the 14 hours between
Washington? Well, that's right. It's virtually day about. Mm-hmm. So you finish work here and then you start work back in Australia as the people get on the phone to you and want this and that. So it's 24/7.
And is there sort of a daily conference call or is it something that you just as situations arise?
As situations arise, yeah. Mm-hmm. For us, the alliance with the United States is critical in many areas, but what a lot of Australians don't know is the significance of the conversation that we're able to have through the Australian Embassy with different sections of the American policymaking establishment. Mm-hmm. And that is a constant source of information back home on not the United States alone, but if there's trouble going on in the Middle East about that, if there's problems in East Asia about that. And really, if it's Africa or South America, where we're not heavily engaged, it's in all areas. It's critical in those areas. Totally the ball game.
Well, Australia is in such a remarkable position because you are defined as a Western country, Western culture, and yet you are right in the heart of the Asia-Pacific region, and that has to give you a perspective on geopolitical realities that no other country really has.
Well, that's true, but it's new. Mm-hmm. That's a valuable asset. You know, when people wrote histories of Australia, when I was studying history at university years ago, the books like Tyranny of Distance were the sorts of books which predominated in the interpretation of the Australian experience.
Focusing on the isolation.
That's right. And indeed, when we first established the ANZUS relationship with the United States, the treaty with the US, which is 60 years old, the US was very reluctant to enter into it. The Joint Chiefs were very reluctant to see the US go into another potentially military commitment. But the United States, even though they thought that Australia inhabited an area of little importance, they nevertheless they wanted Australia's signature on the Japanese peace treaty, so the US was prepared to give it. So we were very, very isolated. Now we stand with an enormously advantageous position. We are the southern tier, or in the southern tier, if you like, of the focal point now of the global political system. The global economy, the global political system revolves around the Asia-Pacific economy. And so all of a sudden, from being terribly distant, we're completely adjacent to this area. So that's one of the advantages for folk here in Dallas in having this direct flight to Australia.
You have said that you don't see the key role of Australia as being a go-between between the United States and China, and yet clearly you have a great deal of influence with both governments. Can you talk a little bit about what you think the appropriate relationship is?
Well, look, the U.S., the Sino-U.S. relationship is intense, much closer than most Americans think. Mm-hmm. It's a conversation that is going on with a very high level of sophistication, with a very high level of mutual understanding, prickliness, probably always will be a bit prickly because the outlook and systems are so totally different. But the economic interests do coincide in many areas. So the US doesn't, and China does not need anyone between them. What they sometimes need is what I'd call a muse, somebody who understands them both pretty well and with whom they can have a trusting conversation. That's probably the US takes advantage of that, obviously, more than China does, but China does a bit, but the US does tend to, American administrations do tend to treat on discussing China policy and policy more generally in East Asia, they tend to treat Australia a bit as a muse, and that's good for us.
Can you give us some examples of how that works for you specifically?
Well, it means that if the United States, for example, would be working out what is the appropriate way or what should be the posture that we adopt on issues related to the South China Seas. Mm-hmm. How do you defend the proposition that there's a global commons issue here? How do you calibrate your relationship with the players in the region who are people who are anxious for an American presence, but the Americans don't want to get into an adversarial type of relationship with China, but they want to be there? Well, how do you calibrate that? Now, that's a conversation the Americans can very usefully have with us. We have a military alliance with Malaysia and Singapore. We have quite intense relationships with Indonesia and with other countries in the region. So it's useful to bounce policy off us. I just cite that as one example. I could cite others.
Mm-hmm. I know that you are a great student of history, and if you look back, I mean, our two countries did not form in exactly the same ways, but certainly they're both places that had indigenous populations and which were transformed in some good ways and in some less positive ways by the influx of European immigrants. Can you talk about what else sort of culturally you think unites these two countries?
Well, you're responsible for us being founded. not folk here in Texas, because Texas was not part of the original foundation of the United States. But I was speaking at Australia Day earlier this year in Boston, and I said, this is completely appropriate for me to be here in Boston. Because when those fellas went and chucked the tea off the side of those ships, they set in train a process which meant that Britain could no longer send convicts to sit on prison hulks and the like in Georgia. Mm-hmm. So instead, they had to send them somewhere else. Where did they send them? They sent them to Australia, and that was the beginning of European settlement. We're not exactly the same. Australians and Americans are not exactly like each other. Americans tend to be more optimistic than we are. They tend to be easier to move around. They find it easier to move around than we do. But there is a considerable similarity in outlook. Some of it may be from that frontier society type of view. Some of it may be from that degree of common origins. Some of it extends from what were considerable interlinkages between Australia and the west coast of the United States. A lot of people don't think about much back in the 19th century. And then, of course, there's the media industry, which has always attracted Australians to the United States and, of course, is the best tool of American soft power that one can imagine.
When we talk about the bilateral relationship between the United States and Australia, obviously we're very strong allies on many platforms. There is this difference, though, in GDP. I think it's, you know, ours is 15 times the size of yours. The population is very different. Does that make it difficult to sort of stand up and be counted fully?
No. What I say to Americans, because this is true, if you're allied to Australia from the United States, it's like being allied to Texas. Mm-hmm. Now, there is a little bit of a consciousness in the mind of the average Texan that they once were an independent republic. So if they imagine themselves an independent republic again and they were establishing a relationship with the United States, that is what we are like. Similar population, very, very similar industrial profile, if you like, and very similar GDP. So it's not... massive, but it's not insignificant. We have the world's, I think, 13th largest economy. We have the world's 11th largest military. So when you go to think of things in those terms, we're not in the top three or four, but we're not completely out of the ballpark. And more importantly these days, we have part of the world's critical geography. We are exactly where the United States needs an ally.
We are also strongly allied in terms of interest in global warming and protecting the environment. Can you talk about some of the efforts that have been made there?
Well, it's controversial in both our countries, isn't it? When push comes to shove, there's a lot of naysayers on the notion of global warming, or at least the man-made causes associated with it.
Even in Australia.
Oh yeah, and that is one of the. There's a substantial political debate going on now in Australia, which, as ambassador, I don't express a political preference on. But the debate is about whether or not the government will successfully get through a regime that prices carbon or carbon emissions. They haven't announced the final format of that yet or the compensation packages associated with it. But the government will do that before the end of the year, and that'll be the debate will revolve around that. But there is a high level of consciousness, nevertheless, in Australia about the issues related to the environment and global warming. So we are beginning to experience in Australia those unprecedented weather events that people talk about. Not unprecedented in character, but unprecedented in volume and frequency.
How has the sort of recovery effort been from the flooding in January of this year?
Well, it's underway. Mm-hmm. A lot recovered very quickly. The broken infrastructure is harder to handle. The government has put in place a special tax levy on the Australian population to pay for it, because they want to still be able to bring the budget into balance in 2 years' time without and yet this crisis induced by the flooding and a recent cyclone, I might say, which is what you call hurricanes, mm-hmm. That is pretty expensive. And so the government is going to pay for that through that tax levy. So it'll be a very quick recovery for people in who lost homes and the like, much slower for the bridges and the road systems and the other areas of infrastructure that were affected.
So that's got to have an impact also on at least the regional economy.
It does. Sometimes it's good. I hate to
really?
Say that.
In the rebuilding?
Yeah, rebuilding. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's investment of money in the economy locally. And there's downsides. The big downside is a sad loss of family treasures and sometimes a loss of life. And these are heartbreaking things that can never be compensated for, if you like. But in terms of the community effect, it's often a big injection of capital when people are doing the rebuild.
My guest is His Excellency Kim Beazley, Australia's ambassador to the United States. He was in town to speak this morning to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. We'll resume our conversation in a moment and invite you to get on the line now to join us. You can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Australia's ambassador to the United States, Kim Beazley. He was in town to speak to an event this morning of the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. And, of course, today is the day that direct service between DFW and Brisbane begins from DFW on Qantas Airways. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Ambassador, Australia has done enviably well weathering the global financial recession. Maybe it hardly really hit you at all. Can you talk about what has worked in Australia's favor?
Well, actually, it hit us very hard, and it was nail-biting. We were lucky to come into it with quite a low level of public debt and quite a reasonably strong budgetary position. So that was fortunate. But we stand at the tail end in many ways of the global economy. So when the tail begins to wag, it acts like a whip at the Australian end of it. So it can be very dangerous. What the government did was go in massively early, hard, big. So every Australian got $1,000 to spend, and most of them spent it. And there was a shovel ready program and all that sort of thing. There's controversy around some of that still, but the effect was to put a floor under the economy. There was also decisions taken to guarantee deposits in banks and a range of financial measures as well. Then the Chinese took as big a hit as the United States. They lost about 30 million jobs in the first few months.
And that's your number one trade partner.
There's our number one trade partner. Yeah, but it's not exclusively our trade partner. It's got about 20-odd percent of our trade, that's less than the Japanese had in the 1980s. But nevertheless, it's important. They stimulated. And when they stimulated, then that drove the unprecedentedly high prices for Australian energy and mineral product. And so we didn't experience it. Our unemployment level is around about 5%. We have a chronic shortage of labour, including in particular in the mining areas. And I know the government is hoping that over the next few years there'll be a level of skilled migration, including from the United States to Australia, to pick that up.
Now, in the past, it was quite difficult, wasn't it, even for skilled labourers to immigrate?
Well, we've had huge migration programs. Excuse me. We had we get about 250,000 people a year. Now, every figure I give you in relation to Australia, you've got to multiply by 15 to 16, and that gives you an American equivalent.
Sure. Yeah.
So that'd be bigger than the legal intake in the United States. So we're a big migration country. Yes, we do. Put on a point system, which means you've got to tick boxes on language and a few things like that. But we also have a pretty generous refugee program and humanitarian program. So it is probably a little bit easier to get into Australia than it is the United States. That is with a document.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to the phones now, and we'll speak with Doug in Farmers Branch. Hi, Doug.
Good afternoon, and good day, mate.
good day, mate.
I want to preface my question with a remark that I am the product of a liaison over the wartime between an Aussie mother and a Yank father. When I was in Sydney in February, I had a cousin remark that, in his view, it would be in the Australian national interest to acquire nuclear submarine technology so that it might exercise its own prerogatives in defending its own interests in the South Pacific. Can you tell us what your thoughts are or what the stance of the Australian government may be in this regard?
I love hearing from Americans who are the children of the large number of Australian war brides who came across the United States. I was here a couple of years ago, and on Anzac Day in Washington, the then ambassador arranged for about 300 or 400 Australian war brides to come to the embassy. They're just wonderful women. And they all keep sort of cut touch with home, though not many go home or went home very regularly. Mm-hmm. They settled in the States and made this their home and raised essentially American children. The question on nuclear submarines, look, it's a question of how you operate submarines and where you operate them. The United States needs nuclear submarines because they accompany US battle fleets. They have to operate very long distances, and they operate essentially in blue water environments. The waters of the Southeast Asian, East Asian region are what you'd describe as a green water environment. Quite shallow. It requires ultra silence. Nuclear submarines can't deliver ultra silence. And most countries that operate large numbers of submarines with a nuclear component also operate conventional submarines as well. The United States doesn't. There's a fixation or a policy decision in the United States Navy that they will not incorporate conventional submarines, even though other nuclear submarine states like Russia, like China, have like the Indians now and the directions they're going, do that, because they serve different strategic purposes. It would be bad news for the United States Navy, in all probability, if Australia decided to move out of conventional diesel submarines into nuclear submarines, because as far as they're concerned in allied relationships, that would be carrying coals to Newcastle. And it's better for the United States to have allies who, if they're not going to have a component of their underwater structure, green water and capacity, at least a friend does.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. If you'd like, you may also send email to think@kera.org. Let's go next on the phones to Roger in Highland Village. Hi, Roger.
Hello. Well, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a little bit of a conspiracy theory for the ambassador. I'd like to bounce off of him, if you don't mind. You know, knowing how the Chinese sometimes operate, I just thought it was very interesting that, you know, we know they backdoor support the regime in North Korea. And I just wonder if they support the saber rattling and the little bumps in peace that happen out of North Korea and keep the United States and the world focused on what's happening there, even though we all know that that economy doesn't produce anything. They can't even really feed their own people, while they secretly maneuver to go for their real prize, which is Taiwan, which is totally dependent upon the U.S. and its allies for its independence and support, which would be kind of a Machiavellian move on the part of the Chinese, especially with our United States beholding in such huge debt quantities to the Chinese. One has to admit that there's a lot more influence there than has been in recent history. I'd like to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I don't think you need to see the policy issues in conspiracy terms there. This is plain sight stuff. The Chinese believe that, and we recognise, both of us actually, both the United States and Australia recognise Taiwan as part of China. We have a distinct view on how that unity ought to occur, and it should under no circumstances occur on the basis of armed force. So that's the position that we adopt. So the Chinese, I think, deal with these two areas in much the same way as when we have problems, we deal with those areas as not necessarily linked, but as issues that have to be handled in themselves. North Korea is a handful for China. There is a reasonable expectation on behalf of all other powers with an interest in East Asian affairs, and that includes us and it includes the United States, a reasonable expectation that the Chinese will guarantee and ensure good behaviour by the North Koreans. And therefore pressure goes from us onto China to do that. The Chinese, on the other hand, say that this is an extremely difficult regime to get on with, an extremely difficult regime to bring to the table and to render reasonable. I think the Chinese get as much of a headache out of their relationship to North Korea as they ever got a benefit.
That's a really interesting perspective because we don't hear that a lot. The assumption, at least in this country, is very often that the Chinese and the North Koreans, if they don't always see eye to eye, at least the Chinese have this outsized influence on North Korea.
Well, I think the Chinese, none of the misbehaviors that we've seen of North Korea over the years that the Chinese think are a good idea.
Yeah.
And therefore, in logic, they'd not be things that they'd want the North Koreans to be doing. Now, we can have a criticism about how effective they are and how assiduous they are in upholding what are the obligations that we assume of them, since they're the backers of that government, to ensure the behaviour of that government. But it was quite an impressive display quite recently, just before Christmas, between China and the United States, who actually crisis managed between them one of those little episodes, and they crisis managed it quite well, which was a very encouraging sign, at least in terms of contemporary Chinese policy. But no, we don't often think of it as a problem. We tend to we remember the Korean War from our point of view, and the large numbers of Americans and from an Australian point of view, Australians who lost their lives. That was as nothing compared to the numbers the Chinese lost. The Chinese lost massive numbers in Korea, maybe close to 1 million people. And the Chinese experience of the Korean War is extremely painful. And they have themselves all sorts of questions in their own minds about Stalin having cut them loose to do that, and what that said about how he saw the revolution in China and how he wanted that nation to be brought into conflict with the United States. And so there's all sorts of interesting interpretations of the Korean War and its origins in China. But there's one thing that is absolutely commonly shared, and that is that China bled massively in the Korean War. The operations of the United Nations, essentially, but basically the United States, were pretty effective in holding the line there. Now, I know that's not a way we normally look at Korea, but we can sort of take a step back these days and look at it, I think, a bit more objectively. So the Chinese are learning what it means to be an international stakeholder at the moment and what is expected of them and how quickly activities that they might undertake can be misinterpreted or seen the wrong way. And having them misinterpreted or seen the wrong way seriously damages Chinese interests. So we're watching a nation rising to prominence, and doing so with the complex learning experiences that most nations rising to prominence have.
Is it your sense that the United States has sort of kept pace with the evolution of China in an appropriate way and amended its own policy toward China, sort of keeping up with how quickly the nation is changing?
Look, I think there are different views in the United States about China and things that ought to happen in relation to it. I think the United States is very good for China. And the experience of a relationship with the United States in the latter phases of the Cold War were positive for China. United States, the relationship with the United States has been positive for Chinese growth. The quiet period in historical terms that the United States has encouraged in the Asia-Pacific region by its presence has given the Chinese the capacity to grow in economic terms without having to focus heavily on their own survival or their own defence. Now, all these things are enormously positive gains that the Chinese have got from the relationship that they have with the United States. Albeit, if you look at the ideological origins of the current Chinese government, it'd be very difficult to accept that analysis. Mm-hmm. But they do. On the other hand, they want to feel their own strength and in the situation in which they now find themselves, a growing economic power. But they understand one thing, and they understand it absolutely. If they are going to rise to prosperity, it can only occur in peaceful circumstances. Mm-hmm. And that they have a shared interest with the United States in ensuring that peaceful circumstances prevail. The question is, what are the terms and conditions of this? And that is what American statesmen now are putting out. And the US has said, for example, again, to the South and East China Seas, where there are clashes of claims, look, these claims have to be resolved in accordance with internationally accepted principles, legal principles. And they need to be resolved in the context of what ought to be a common human understanding of the global commons and all our rights of access to it. That's one power which upholds the capacity for those rules to prevail, and that's the United States. And that's why the United States is there. It's not there to, in the Cold War context of a relationship with the Soviet Union, to contain China.
Mm-hmm.
It is there to uphold international practices which guarantee everybody's prosperity and peaceful resolution of territorial disputes. So, now, not all Americans share that view about what America is doing there or that analysis of what is going on in the region and the implications of it. But I have to say that the American administration, both the previous one and this one, operate in China policy with great levels of sophistication and with much higher levels of success than often people who are commentators on them are inclined to give them.
Can you talk about this just in terms of contemporary diplomacy? How much, and not just in your own role, but that of others in your position, how much of what an ambassador does is sort of the portion of the iceberg underneath the water in terms of what you do most effectively actually happens behind closed doors as opposed to the very public aspects of your job?
About 90%.
90%. So it is like the tip of the iceberg is all the public stuff that people...
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My guest is Ambassador of Australia to the United States, Kim Beazley. He's in town. He was speaking this morning to a sold-out event at the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. We'll resume our conversation, take more of your calls, read some of your emails after the break. You can get to us online at think@kera.org, or you can call in to 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is His Excellency Kim Beazley, Ambassador of Australia to the United States. He was in town to speak to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth this morning. If you'd like to join the conversation, send email to think@kera.org. That's where we hear from Jim. Switching gears here just a bit, Jim wants to know, would Australia be a good place for a U.S. citizen to retire to, and are there many retired Americans there?
There is quite a few. Not huge numbers, but it is a very good place to retire to. But you'd have to bear a couple of things in mind, I think. United States is much cheaper than Australia in everything except education and health, in which Australia is vastly cheaper than the United States. But when you're retiring, education tends to be fairly irrelevant to you.
Mm-hmm.
Health is not irrelevant. And health in Australia is quite affordable. So it is a good place to retire, but you would probably be shocked by the prices. It's a good place environmentally to retire, but the cost of living in Australia is quite high compared to the US.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the line to Tom in Dallas. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Great, thanks.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And hi, Tom.
I would like to ask Mr. Beazley. I lived in Australia from 02 to 05, and this is along the lines of your last question. The things that I noticed quite different about it, one, I would like him to discuss the differences between having 20 million people and 300 million people like here in the United States.
Yeah.
things seem to get done a lot more quickly with Parliament, so on and so forth. Secondly, the difference in the personal income tax structure, because it is a very expensive place to live. For example, when I lived there, I think the top tax rate was 47% for anything over $57,000. And you were not able to deduct things like mortgage interest. Presented, I think, major differences in the economic structure.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks very much, Tom.
Country.
Yeah, look, you've got a pretty good impression of things there. It is a lot easier to manage 20 million people than 300 million, that is to be said. And we have, even though our institutions sound like American institutions, House of Representatives, Senate, states, you know, Supreme Court, I think we call it High Court, et cetera. And the Australian founders 100 plus years ago, who founded the Australian Constitution from six self-governing colonies, tended to take American nomenclature for just about everything, but not necessarily the system looks technically the same, but isn't.
Mm-hmm.
We have a Westminster system of government, so the government sits in the parliament, and as a result, it must control at least the House of Representatives. We have an odd situation at the moment, a minority government, but that's very unusual. Generally speaking, it's majority government in the House of Representatives, and that means in practical terms that once you make a decision, you can actually legislate it quite quickly. And so the Australian Parliament, which doesn't sit for the same length of time as the US Congress, nevertheless would probably pass 10 times the legislation during the course of the year through both houses of Parliament. So in government efficiency terms, it's a bit better. In sort of representative democracy terms, probably not so much so, but certainly in efficiency terms. Now, on the taxation regime, we do have a top marginal rate, which is a bit less than 47 cents now, but it's well into the 40s. It's not actually doesn't cut in at 57,000. That I think the top rate cuts in around about 150. On the income tax side and the Commonwealth government, that's our national government, would be higher. Undoubtedly, the tax rates would be higher than in Washington and in the United States generally, even with state income taxes added in. But when you come over onto the property tax side, we are negligible compared to the US. You know, rates in a suburb that I live in, which is a good suburb in Perth in Western Australia, it's about $2,400 a year. And the same sort of house in any major US town, you'd probably be talking $15,000-$20,000 for the property taxes on that. So that's that element of state taxation much lower in Australia, but the income tax is higher. But you can see it in GDP terms. In the US, 24% of US GDP is what the national government spends. That's the spending side of the US government.
Right.
They raise 15% of GDP in taxes. That gap is the US deficit, and that's a problem. Australia also, at the national government level, 24% of GDP is in national government spending. 23% of GDP is raised in tax, and those two figures will come together 2 years from now. So when you take a look at that, you'd have to say in all probability that Australian taxation levels were higher.
As you spent 27 years as a partisan politician, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, and part of the time as opposition leader. Do the skills that you have to use in party politics, do they translate exactly into diplomacy? Are they very different?
They don't actually translate at all. Diplomacy is a completely non-partisan feature of the political scene, if you like. You're there to represent an Australian national interest, not an Australian partisan interest or a partisan political interest from within Australia.
And you've now served under two prime ministers, although from the same party.
They're all from the same party, yeah. But if the Conservatives were to win office in Australia, that's not what we call them, but if I did say what we do call them, everybody would misunderstand in the United States. They're called Liberals. Mm-hmm. But were they to come into power, then I would serve my contract out. They don't have that same sort of partisan view about some ambassadors that you see in the United States, whereby you resign the moment there's a change of administration. So I'd say that political skills probably help a bit, but the partisan component of it, not at all.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Ed in Fort Worth. Hi, Ed.
Hello. Welcome to Texas, Mr. Ambassador.
Good to be here, Ed.
Yes, sir. I have a question. Could you briefly give us an overview of your immigration policy, how it stands in Australia, say, as a rough comparison to the United States?
Yeah.
Being that we have such diverse borders, north and south, and such a huge population, how does Australia deal with their immigration policy down there?
Well, it's a controversial issue in Australia, too. There's no doubt at all that immigration policy can tax people's patience in a multiplicity of different ways. So if you look at Australia's debate, there is a concern with the possibility of illegal entry into Australia. In Australia, that tends to occur by people undertaking aircraft movement and then breaching the conditions of their visa. Or it can occur by people who take very dangerous passage on boats, which is a practice Australian governments try desperately to deter so that people don't do it.
Where do they come from? Indonesia?
They come through Indonesia. Mm-hmm. They don't come from Indonesia. They tend to come from the Middle East, mm-hmm, or South Asia. Sometimes, or in times past, from China, Vietnam, but mostly now from the Middle East or South Asia. So this raises hackles, fears in Australia from a conservative side of politics, and it raises concerns from a humanitarian point of view of people getting themselves on these dangerous boats, and many drowning, mm-hmm, and many do. Via this process, about 4,000 or 5,000 people are coming into Australia, which would be probably about a day's experience on the American border. So there is there's a very different dimension here. Mm-hmm. It's very much harder to get into Australia than it is to get into the United States. We have no borders.
Right.
It's a continent completely isolated by sea. But that doesn't stop people worrying about it, and we worry about it a lot. But generally speaking, our view on migration is it's nation building. We need migrants. And so Australians have historically had a very high, at least since World War II, have had a very high migration program. It was once racially discriminatory. It ceased to be racially discriminatory in the 1960s. And ever since then, it's been based around criteria of family reunion, criteria of skills, criteria of humanitarian. Once, of course, though, you are in Australia, you're in a position to bring in substantial numbers of family members from elsewhere. So if you come from, say, for argument's sake, from India, then you have a capacity to bring in large numbers of others. It's created in Australia a genuinely multicultural society, which has some resemblance to the society that's here. We're a bit of a melting pot, too. I remember, I don't want to run out of time, but I met with Gerry Adams of Sinn Féin a few years ago. He's passing through Australia, and he was shocked. I was about the last person he'd seen. He came to Australia expecting to find what you find in the United States. So we're a majority Catholic country, which suggests we've got a large Irish population, which you do, people of Irish origin. He expected to find, like you do in the United States, Irish conclaves in New York, Chicago, Boston. Mm-hmm. Came to Australia and couldn't find any. And the culture was not English and Irish. The culture was hybrid Australian, with obvious contributions from both. and that everybody in Australia who'd had origins that went back a generation or two tended to have both English and Irish components of their forebears. And he'd never seen that before. And he was shocked by it. So we're not a bad melting pot either. And when you consider the fellow who is the greatest scorer of points in rugby league is a fellow named Hassan El Masri, who is from the Middle East and a migrant to Australia from the Middle East. It does say something about the integrating capacity of the Australian nation. So it's controversial, migration. But I'd say in Australia there's a very much higher level of consciousness about the nation-building role that it behaves.
I want to talk, Ambassador, to close here, just a little bit about the tourism industry. Obviously, many Americans who are listening, many North Texans, know Australia because they have been there as tourists. Are there things that Americans always tend to do, and are there things that they miss out on simply because they weren't aware that there are wonderful different things to do in Australia?
Well, you know, I would encourage them to fly on Qantas, of course, to come to Australia.
As of today.
And particularly now, out of Dallas, there's four services a week, and they'll find the Qantas experience terrific. Americans do the sorts of things that you see on TV. They like the outback. They like to see Ayers Rock. They like to see the Barrier Reef. Former President Clinton came out and snorkeled on the Barrier Reef a while back, did scuba diving there. These are the sorts of things. So we've got lovely beaches, and Americans tend to take a look at that. I'd like to attract them a bit further west, to where I come from, great wine country in the southwest of Western Australia. But by and large, Americans know us pretty well. We're not a mystery to you, and in the same way as you're not a mystery to us. And so you'll find when you come to Australia, provided you keep away from the snakes, the crocodiles, and the poisonous spiders, you have a very, very good chance of surviving happily.
And lots of sunscreen is important as well.
Sunscreen's important. There is a depleted ozone layer down in the southern hemisphere, so keep your sunscreen and your hats on.
Has everyone been disappointed that President Obama's trips keep getting pushed back?
Oh, they'd love to see him. Australia would love it if they like U.S. presidential visits, and they'd love to see President Obama come to Australia, and hopefully that'll happen at some time in the next couple of years. He'd be very welcome. Australia's very interested in U.S. politics and U.S. presidents, more interested in U.S. politics and presidents than Americans are. 83%, according to Pew Research, Americans were interested in the last presidential election, but 84% of Australia.
Very impressive. His Excellency Kim Beazley is Australia's ambassador to the U.S. Ambassador Beazley, thank you so much for joining us.
Very good to be with you.
My name is Chris
Boyd. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.